for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's amazing. The conservatives are eating their own. House Majority Leader John Boehner, this morning said, quote, "I believe I talked to the speaker," he's talking about Denny Hastert, "and he told me that it's been taken care of, and my position is it's his corner, it's his responsibility." It's all about the Mark Foley scandal. The guy who is now sitting in Tom DeLay's seat continues to say, John Boehner, I guess, "the clerk of the House who runs the page program, the page board, all report to the speaker, and I believe it has been dealt with." Yeah. So, and it's really quite extraordinary. I mean, how yesterday, David, I sent you that that email with the link on the Google News thing and the top stories, and I never saw that again. A friend of ours looked at Google News yesterday afternoon, and the story that Condi Rice was briefed and did know in July, the July 10 story, 7-10, that Condi Rice on July 10th knew that this had fallen off the scale. It was not even showing among the top stories in Google News. Incredible. And this is what I was predicting yesterday, that it was going to be all Foley all the time. And was frankly dismayed to hear on the radio throughout the day and on television that was pretty much the only thing anybody wanted to talk about. Yeah, it's blowing up in the face of the Republicans. But this is the biggest story. I mean, if 2001 is a big deal, you know, Foley's gone. He's resigned from Congress. Now, of course, it's the cover-up that's the big deal, and as is so often the case, the cover-up is more destructive than the crime itself. I mean, it was Martha Stewart got nailed for lying to the FBI for an attempted cover-up. It was Bill Clinton who got impeached for trying to cover up, you know, what he did. Richard Nixon, who brought articles of impeachment against him in the House. They didn't have to go through a formal vote because he resigned over a cover-up. And so it was the cover-up that was worse than the crime in some regards, historically, at least politically, that's certainly the case. And legally, I guess, in many regards. And so now it has flipped. But, you know, I find this so interesting. Another one of our listeners pointed out, you know, I had suggested yesterday that this thing was, this is a big deal, you know, and this is not going away tomorrow morning, and that you wonder what ABC has to do with all of this. Yeah, here's the top stories. North Korea says nuclear test is set. Killer was angry at life, angry at God. Iran must halt atomic work. Japan backs talented Bin Ban as UN chief. Uneasy calm returns to Gaza strips. Conservative paper calls for Foley's resignation. 6 dead in Amish shootings. Amid fear of copycats, school girds for security. You know, it's not. It's not even on the list. The fact that Condi Rice knew in July that something like 9/11 was probably going to be happening, and did nothing about it. Now, call me strange if you want, but I'll tell you, 9/11 to me, and the fact that the Bush administration did absolutely nothing to stop 9/11 for 8.5 months, from the time George Bush was installed by the Supreme Court in January until 9/11, during that entire period of time, they did nothing. They demoted Richard Clark. Dick Cheney was in charge of the counterterrorism task force and never met until September of 2001. On 9/11, Condi Rice was scheduled to give a speech promoting Star Wars. That was the sole focus of the Bush administration. They thought that Bill Clinton was crazed, was the phrase that one of the folks inside the administration used, Bob Woodward uses in his book, was crazed over bin Laden, that he was inappropriately obsessed with bin Laden. This is what the Bushies thought. And so when the CIA director and the head of counterterrorism, Richard Clark, at Tenet, and Richard Clark come and say, "Hey, you know, this thing is coming. Oh, you know, that's that Clinton obsession. And these guys are holdovers from the Clinton administration. You know, Tenet appointed him a CIA director. And Clark, he's been around all the way back to Reagan. He's been in his job too long. I mean, yeah, it's just, come on. This is not serious stuff. And that's the real story in my mind. Now, with regard to the Foley story, here's another interesting take on this thing. And I alluded to this yesterday. And Michael sends me a note here. He says, the only, as far as I can tell, the only mainstream news media source promoting the story initially was ABC News, which is owned by Disney. And ABC Disney recently aired the factually challenged path to 9/11, despite numerous gross inaccuracies and an obvious political slant. They're trying to curry favor of the Republican Party. So here you have ABC running path to 9/11, in which they say 9/11 was Bill Clinton's fault, not George Bush's. Woodward has written a book which essentially says, no, 9/11 happened because Rice and Bush and Cheney decided to ignore bin Laden for 8 months, for the first 8 months of the Bush presidency. They completely ignored him. The book, by the way, was scheduled for release the week before the November elections, the last week of October. Woodward now says he pushed really hard to get the release of the book moved up 3 weeks so that it wouldn't influence the elections. So anything in the book, the Republicans would have time to rebut. And they are. And so Woodward schedules this interview with 60 Minutes. The book is just now starting to become available in galleys. It's just starting to get out there. And the ABC gets wind of the story that Woodward is going to be busting open something that's going to give the lie to the ABC documentary. I mean, this may have nothing to do whatsoever, even with Republican-Democratic politics. Could just you know, have to do very simply with ABC wanting to retain their credibility and, frankly, to make more money. Because if the other networks, when the other networks go to CBS and they say, we'd like to run that Woodward clip, CBS says, fine, cross our palms with cash. And when the networks come to ABC and they say, we'd like to run some of this stuff about Foley, ABC says, fine, cross our palms with cash, or credit us. Either way, you know, they win. So ABC wins the ratings war. They make more money if they out Foley at that particular moment in time. Plus, they get to knock down CBS. ABC wins all the way around. Plus, if there really is a political agenda here where ABC and Disney are trying to, you know, basically be in bed with the Republicans and suck up to the Republican Party and be nice to them and help them out, then probably they figured, okay, we're going to throw one congressman under the bus, but it's going to prevent the entire administration from being brought down by the story that they were told in July that 9/11 was on its way, and they chose intentionally to do nothing about it. I don't think that ABC had any idea that there was a cover-up. Now the cover-up is blowing up in the face of the Republican Party, and they're doing damage control. And now you've got, you know, Tony Perkins. This is so sad. I mean, this is so sad. Tony Perkins, the president of the Family Research Council. Now, he is not a minister. He just plays one on television. No, I'm serious. The guy is not an ordained minister or anything. He just puts himself out as Mr. Family Values, head of the Family Research Council on CNN. Talking about how,
Please speak, sir. John Simkus is still the chairman of the Page Board. Would you send your child to Washington to be a page?
Oh, I there's no defense of this behavior. It's outrageous. It's shocking. But it shouldn't be totally surprising when we hold up, tolerance and diversity as the guidepost for public life. This is what you end up with.
You hold up tolerance and diversity. And he also says the House leadership didn't do anything about this because they didn't want to be accused of being homophobes.
No kidding. You've got congressmen chasing 16-year-old boys down the halls of Congress. It's a shame. It's a tragedy. And it does need to be addressed, but not just the symptoms here. We need to go to the source of the problem. And if the leadership was negligent, it should be dealt with, and it should be dealt with in the most severe way as possible. But what prevented the leadership from acting? Were they fearful of acting because they would be seen as homo homophobic or gay bashing.
See, this is the same meme that Newt Gingrich was putting out yesterday. Let's try to conflate pedophilia with homosexuality. Let's say, you know, and this is because of diversity, tolerance. These guys hunted down Bill Clinton and tried to drive him out of office by one vote in the Senate. They would have eliminated him as president of the United States for having sex with a consulting adult, but they want to give a pass to Foley for trying to have sex with minors. This is wrong. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Black and white, pictures of a license plate. Black and white, picture of a life remains.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. This is from the Bloomington Normal Daily Pentagraph. Yes, that's the name of the newspaper in Bloomington, Ohio. In Toledo, Ohio, a man named Dick Cheney wrote a letter to the editor criticizing President Bush. He was then maligned himself when readers mistook him for being the vice president, wrote the 74-year-old Cheney in a follow-up letter. It's my name and I had it before he did. I'm not changing it just because it's associated with that dweeb. Dick Cheney does not like Dick Cheney at all, apparently. By the way, just a heads up for our listeners in Washington State, in the Seattle area and environs, on October 6th, Friday night, I will be at the town hall. I'll be at town hall signing Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, at town hall, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $5, and basically all of that's just going to pay for the cost of town hall, frankly. They're available in advance at Elliott Bay Bookstore, who is putting this thing on, and they'll be selling books at the, you know, books will be available at town hall. That's at 1119 8th Avenue at Seneca. And also on the 5th, on Thursday night, I'll be at Annie Bloom's Books at 7:30 in Portland, Oregon, for our listeners in Portland on KPOJ, AM 620 KPOJ. So 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. The CBS Evening News, getting more and more conservative under the editorship of Katie Couric. Last night, in response to the murder, the horrific murder of what is now, I believe, five young women at this school in this Amish school, they put on Mr. Brian Rorbo, whose son was one of the kids who were killed in the Columbine massacre. And this is what CBS Evening News broadcast to millions, tens of millions of people.
I'm saddened and shaken by the shooting at an Amish school today and last week's school murders. When my son Dan was murdered on the sidewalk at Columbine High School on April 20th, 1999, I hoped that would be the last school shooting. Since that day, I tried to answer the question, why did this happen?
And then Mr. Rorbaugh goes on CBS Evening News to their tens of millions of viewers to answer the question, why the school shooting? Why this Amish school? Why?
This country is in a moral freefall. For over two generations, the public school system is taught in a moral vacuum, expelling God from the school.
It's because we're not praying in school anymore. That's why the shooting took place. And there's probably more.
And from the government, replacing him with evolution.
It's evolution, replacing God with evolution in our schools. That's why the shooting took place.
Wrong kill the weak without moral consequences. And life has no inherent value. We teach there are no absolutes, no right or wrong. And I assure you, the murder of innocent children is always wrong.
I don't recall anybody saying that there's no right or wrong and no moral absolutes. This is the worst kind of right-wing propaganda. He continues to conflate, to essentially say that the reason why the school shootings happened was because abortion is legal in the United States.
Including by abortion. Abortion has diminished the value of children. suicide has become an acceptable action.
And taking pot shots here in Oregon at our death with dignity law that allows people who are terminal, who have two doctors sign off saying, yes, this person will be dead within 6 months, who are in horrible pain, to be prescribed medication that will allow them to, in a painless and dignified way, end their own lives.
Further embolden these criminals. We are seeing an epidemic increase in murder-suicide attacks on our children. Sadly, our schools are not safe. In fact, we now witness that within our schools, our children have become a target of terrorists from within the United States.
And therefore, by implication, anybody who wants to keep abortion legal in the United States, anybody who wants to teach evolution in the schools, or anybody who suggests that children in school should not be forced to pray, or that the Ten Commandments should not be on display in public places, are terrorists. This on the CBS Evening News last night. I kid you not. That is from the CBS Evening News last night. Oh, man. Yeah, there is moral decay in the United States. I'll tell you, there's some serious moral decay going on in the United States right now. And it is fundamentally happening among the conservatives and within the Republican Party, although in the Democratic Party as well, among those people who say, we're not all in this together. It's every man for himself. We were not really a nation of barn gathering and barn raising communities. We were instead a nation of independent people who went out all by themselves and created and built this. I'm sorry, they're wrong. They'd say, no, a chain is not as strong as its weakest link. You're only a link and stand alone on your own 2 feet. We are community. That's the history in this country, is the idea that we are community. And the moral decay is the conservative idea that we should just, to hell with community. We don't need Social Security. Let's privatize it. We don't need a national health care program. Let's keep this private program where people like Bill Frist's daddy can become multi-billionaires and 45, 46 million people have no access to health care because they are completely uninsured or very limited and very expensive access, where half of all bankruptcies are the result of people getting sick and 3/4 of them were insured. That's how incompetent the insurance is. That's the moral decay in this country. And the tragedy all the more. 27 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Minutes past the hour, listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, brought to you by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time at 800-425-2532, sacredgroundscoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com. Get the latest iPods, 1-800-511-MAX. Eco Wine, the organic wine company, ecowine.com, 1-888-ECO-WINE. And, of course, the sponsors on your local radio station. Please let them know that you're listening and that you intend to buy their products and do so. Indeed. Welcome back. Bill Frist has a great new idea. He's over in Afghanistan right now, along with his good friend Mel Martinez, the Republican from Florida. The Tennessee Republican said he learned from briefings that Taliban fighters were too numerous and had too much popular support to be defeated on the battlefield, said Frist during a brief visit to U.S. and Romanian air bases in the southern Taliban stronghold of Gulat. You need to bring them into a more transparent type of government, and if that's accomplished, we'll be successful. In other words, let's just turn Afghanistan over to the Taliban. Let's let the Taliban participate in governing Afghanistan. That's the solution. Mel Martinez, the Republican from Florida, he says, yeah, this is not out of the question, bringing back the Taliban. This is a variation on what the good senator from Vermont had suggested to, as I recall, Richard Nixon back in the 70s. He said, why don't you just declare victory and come home? But it's got to be totally weird for all the warmonger cons out there to have Frist say this. 1-866-440-8466, our number. I was going to go to Steve in Atlanta first. I had we had a call here who is a conservative who is going to take me on, but he's dropped off the phone. Give us a call back, Steve. We always take our conservative callers first. Greg in Houston, Texas. Hey, Greg.
Hey, John. How you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I watched the free speech last night on the CBS News.
Yeah.
My comment is, where are the parents in providing the moral clarity for the children?
Well, it wasn't a child who went into a school and shot it up. It was
right.
This was
but
a milkman.
He's talking about the schools are godless. There's no God in school. We've taken away prayer.
Right, so essentially what he's saying is it's not the responsibility of parents to raise their children, it's the responsibility of schools.
That's the mentality of the country right now. Where are the parents?
Yeah, that's the mentality of the right-wingers, frankly.
And
the other thing that is immoral, I'll tell you, it is harder and harder now for parents to raise a family. Right, if you compare today with 1970, the pay for pay, work for work, what took one person working in a family in 1970 in terms of the ability to raise kids, put them through school, pay for medical expenses, pay for college, the basics of a middle-class lifestyle now takes two people.
That is correct.
And that is not, and I'm not saying, oh, gee, the woman should stay home with the family. It's not that kind of thing. It is somebody should be there for the kids, male or female, and the family and parents should have more time with the kids. And with this crushing of the middle class, this economic crushing of the middle class, more than half of all children now in America come home to nobody at home, to an empty home. You know, we've got a nation of latchkey kids, and so they're being raised by what? They're being raised by MTV. They're being raised, and that's not specifically to criticize MTV, but they're being raised by, well, CBS, ABC, and NBC. I mean, they're being raised by, and if they have the unfortunate luck of turning on cable, they get to see right wingers like Glenn Beck and Tucker Carlson. I mean, and Joe Scarborough. It's all right wing all the time, or it's all sex, violence, and innuendo all the time.
You're correct there, Tom, because I have two young children, and unfortunately, both my wife and I have to work. And my children are the age to where they can get off the bus. They're young teenagers. They can go home and stay home by themselves now. But in order for us to maintain a house, a car, and food on the table, we both must work.
Right, and to provide for any kind of possibility of sending these kids to college and make sure that you have some kind of a retirement. I mean, this just shouldn't be. It should be that with one paycheck you can raise a family in America. That's the American dream. And
that's the way my father did it.
That's how my father did it too. Working in a tool and die shop, he raised four boys. And here we are. And six people in a three bedroom house. I mean, I'm not saying we were poor. We were solidly middle class. We had bunk beds, but it wasn't bad. I remember my childhood as being really good, and Dad, up until the day he died just a few months ago, had Blue Cross Blue Shield because of a union job, and he had a pension that paid the same amount. Actually, it was an escalator for inflation. That paid him until the day he died, and my mom is still getting something from that. And that's how it used to be, and that's not how it is any longer. That is the moral dilemma in the United States, and frankly,
that is true. That is true.
Greg, I got to move along. Thanks for the call, Lisa in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Lisa.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had this question, and people always think I'm kidding when I ask it, but I'm actually really serious, and I would like for you to explain to me why it would be a bad idea for this country to split into two separate countries. Because it is obvious with this constant tug of war between us and them, there's never going to be a resolution. And, I mean, for Pete's sake, these people that are in power now came from the Ford administration.
Well,
and
here's,
so,
yeah, you're right.
It's a constant battle. How are we ever going to win? And why don't we just call it even, split the country, and have the progressives take one half and have the...
We'll take the coasts, and they can have the Midwest. Here's the problem, Lisa. When you drill down below the surface, when you just like scratch the surface veneer off, which unfortunately is only as far as the mainstream media goes, is the surface. When you get below the surface, you discover that the vast majority of Americans, I mean, well over 80% of Americans, share essentially the same set of values. The vast majority of Americans would like there to be a strong and vibrant middle class. They believe that we should have Social Security, and it should actually be enough that you can actually live on it. They believe that we should have a national health insurance plan that protects everybody. They believe we should have public schools where the classrooms are small enough that kids can actually learn. I mean, there was a news story. Actually, it was in the comics in the Los Angeles Times. I was reading a comic strip on Sunday. I was in the airport flying out of L.A., and one of the right-wing cartoonist, it must have been, he made the point that right now government employees make on average about twice what people do in the private sector. And his context for this was, you know, in terms of pay, benefits, and pension, right, and health benefits. And his context for this was complaining about it, that government employees are overpaid. Well, when I was growing up, if you got a job with the state or federal government, you were making less money than you could make in the private sector and less benefits. Now it's more. Well, the pay for government workers has not changed. What has changed is the pay for everybody else. And so the cons are saying, okay, now we've wiped out the middle class in terms of the middle class people who work for industry. Now let's wipe out the middle class who work for government. And it is a sickness. But the reality is, Lisa, that I think most Americans are with us. And so I don't think we need to split up the country. I think we just need to awaken the country.
Look what they've done. They are winning. Now, of course, hopefully we will win.
No, they're not winning.
But, I mean,
they're winning some elections.
Business, they control media. They control everything. And they are constantly, I mean, for Pete's sake, I work for the union. And the majority of the people I work with are Republicans.
Yeah.
And they don't give it that they're voting against, you know, their own best interest by voting Republican because it's a moral issue.
Lisa, this too shall pass. This is not the first time that big business and concentrated media have had control of this country. It's happened twice before since the founding of this country, and both times it lasted about 25 to 30 years, and it collapsed. And we're about 20 years into it this time.
So I will trust that. I will trust that that's the case. But some days it gets really hard to be very optimistic.
I understand, but you know the fact of the matter is most Americans are with us. They really and truly are, and that's why these guys have to resort to these very, very, very narrow slice issues like whether or not gays should be allowed to marry, or whether or not teenagers should get permission from their parents before they can have an abortion, or whether or not it should be illegal to burn a flag. They have to resort to issues which are micro issues, because on the macro issues, on the big issues, the vast majority of Americans are absolutely united, and they're united behind policies that are the old-fashioned Republican Party policies. Lisa, I've got to move along. Steve in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
Hey, when I hear one of them ultra-conservative right-wingers like that talk about praying in school, you know, in the Bible, there's verses that are written in red, and those are the words of Jesus.
Yep.
And they...
in a red letter Bible.
Right. Written in red, it says, lock yourself in your closet when you pray. Don't be like the hypocrites that pray in public so that men will look on them and say, oh, look how righteous they are, because that's their reward.
Yeah, that's
when
from
you, when
the Sermon
pray,
on the Mount.
Lock yourself in your closet and pray in secret, because what the good Lord hears in secret, he rewards you openly. And I wonder why the people that claim to be Christians want to contradict the words of Christ who they're supposed to be following.
Yeah, well, it's a very good question, and I've always, frankly, personally been uncomfortable with public prayer because I was raised reading the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5-7, where Jesus, you know, comes right out and says that, and he says the same thing about tithing. You know, if you're gonna help somebody, help them in secret. In fact, when I was a kid, the Boy Scout motto was "Do a good deed every day." I got to tell you a story about that right after the break. But right now, it's time for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question today: Bill Frist says who should be allowed to participate in governing Afghanistan? For the sixth caller with the correct answer at 866-440-8466 gets an autographed copy of Screwed. 45 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There'll be a once-was-an election by unpopular selection of an imbecilic lying father's son. Because he was next in line to rise.
back up from the slime and take the throne back to their tie in Washington. Will this I know?
This I know.
Will this I know?
This I know.
Will humanity make every punk so low? Will there might be a solution that bring on a revolution? Cause the royalty oligarchy's gotta go. They undermine the treaty that still helps the poor, the needy as a payback to the greedy and far right. In the anger of the nature, hiding up the melting glacier, and the dream of peace has vanished overnight. Where does that know?
And welcome back to the Democracy Zone. Tom Hartman here with you 9 minutes before the hour. Congratulations. Our question, our progressive pop quiz question. Bill Frist says, who should be allowed to participate in governing Afghanistan? Congratulations to David Hansen from Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. There you go. Congratulations, David. He knew that the correct answer is the Taliban. Yes, Bill Frist, now a fan of the Taliban, apparently. By the way, heads up, Link TV is going to be broadcasting a four-hour special, Rich and Poor, Inequality in America, on Friday, October 6th, Wednesday, October 11th, and Saturday, October 28th, and I am in it. Features a sit-down with author Tom Hartman, as well as Will Durst and a whole bunch of other cool folks. So it should be a good time. Good time had by all. And you can linktv.org more information if you want to pursue that. George W. Bush, quote, I am satisfied that I never saw any intelligence that indicated there was going to be an attack on America. I can't believe this. This is what he said. I am satisfied that I never saw any intelligence that indicated there was going to be an attack on America at a time and a place, an attack. Period. End of sentence. You might recall the hijacking referred to in the presidential daily briefing. It was not the hijacking of an airplane to fly into a building. It was a hijacking of planes in order to free somebody who was being held as a prisoner in the United States. Huh? In fact, here's the report from the PBS NewsHour. April 12, 2004, an intelligence document submitted to President Bush on August 6, 2001 warned that al-Qaeda terrorists already living in the United States could be planning airplane hijackings or the targetings of buildings with explosives possibly in New York and Washington. The White House declassified the document at the request of the 9/11 Commission. The document, reportedly prepared by a CIA analyst, was entitled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. Quote, after U.S. missile strikes on his base in Afghanistan in 1998, Bin Laden told followers he wanted to retaliate in Washington. Al-Qaeda members, including some who are U.S. citizens, have resided in and traveled to the U.S. for years, and the group apparently maintains a support structure that could aid attacks. So, there it is. FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings and other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York, the document said. Well, this was, according to Bush, though, this was not a warning that an attack was coming. No. And now Bob Woodward coming out saying Condi was warned about this thing. In fact, this is one of the people who actually prepared the briefing for Condi. McClatchy, the guy's name, talking about this. This, you know, quoting from Bob Woodward. One official who helped to prepare the briefing, which included a PowerPoint presentation, described it as a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10 that connected the dots in earlier intelligence reports to present a stark warning that al-Qaeda, which had already killed Americans in Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and East Africa, was poised to strike again. The briefing was intended to connect the dots contained in other intelligence reports and paint a very clear picture of the threat posed by Bin Laden, said the official who described the tone of the report as scary. First, Condoleezza Rice said, I don't even remember having a meeting on July 10th with Kofor Black and George Tenet. And then later when they came out and said, yeah, we actually had that meeting with her, she says, this is her spokesman, Sean McCormick, he says, the information Rice got was not new. Rather, it was a good summary from the threat reporting from the previous several weeks. Oh, so now, I guess that explains it all. You've just been told this for weeks and did nothing. But, of course, ABC wants to be sure, backing up their documentary, The Path to 9/11, that we're not talking about this, that we're talking about the disgraced Congressman Mark Foley. It's just absolutely bizarre. John in Pasadena, California. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Nice seeing you over the weekend. Thanks for signing my book.
You're welcome. Thanks for showing up at Romans for the book signing.
Yeah, it was great. Actually, my 15-year-old's been reading your book over the weekend and really enjoys, you know, he says he's learning things from that book that he doesn't learn in school. But
I mean, it's great that he's learning them. It's a shame that he's not learning them in school. Is that We the People you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, We the People.
Exactly.
That's a great history textbook, We the People. And in comic book form, 130-page comic book. Not to plug my own book, but I think it's one of my favorites of my books. Anyhow, what's up, John? We have about a minute here before we got to wrap this hour up.
I'm going to change from the reason I called. My mother grew up during World War II when she's German. And she grew up here, and she, when this law passed last week, or I don't know if Bush has signed on it, I haven't been paying attention.
He hasn't signed it yet, no. I don't think so.
It scared her because she said during World War II, her family was scared to death that they were going to be put in concentration camps.
Yeah, there was discussion of that, actually. There was discussion of that, of rounding up Germans in the United States, and Roosevelt decided just to round up Japanese on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Which the Supreme Court, by the way, supported him in. I mean, people say, the Supreme Court's going to knock this down. The Supreme Court supported Roosevelt in rounding up the Japanese. There is precedent for when we are very afraid, are acting very badly in this country. And John, thanks for the call. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. We need to speak out. I'm telling you. And we need to hold our elected officials accountable for this. 56 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, the place where being progressive never felt so good. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Our quote for the day, Benjamin Franklin, we must all hang together, or assuredly, we shall all hang separately, an increasing possibility. By the way, the Democrats who voted to give George W. Bush the power to declare you or me an enemy combatant, an enemy of the state, and therefore throw us into jail without ever even being charged with a crime for the rest of our natural lives. Interesting. Tim Carper of Delaware voted for this. He was the Democratic Leadership Council, DLC, New Democrat of the Week, April 29th, 2002. Tim Johnson, Democrat of South Dakota. He was a member of the Senate New Democrat Coalition. Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, she was the DLC New Democrat of the Week, December 16th, 2002. Ben Nelson of Florida, member of the Democratic Leadership Council and membership of the Senate New Democrat Coalition. Ben Nelson of Nebraska, the DLC New Democrat of the Week, June 1st, 2005. Mark Pryor of Arkansas, the DLC New Democrat of the Week, October 14th, 2003. Ken Salazar of Colorado, the DLC New Democrat of the Week, October 8th, 2004. Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, member of the Congressional Leadership Council and a member of the Senate New Democrat Coalition. And Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, DLC New Democrat of the Week, August 7th, 2000. Thank you, DLC. Sidney Blumenthal is with us. He has a new book out, How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime. Sidney, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Hey, how is the Bush administration radical? Why do you use the word radical?
Just what you mentioned about torture. Bush is trying to concentrate unaccountable power in the executive. Cheney is the visionary here. It goes back to his experience in the Nixon White House when Nixon's imperial presidency was toppled in Watergate, and Cheney learned that the lesson really was burn the tapes. Now, torture is emblematic of the kind of policy in which the commander-in-chief, using the rationale of wartime, can act on his own to make any law he wishes, even abrogating international treaties to which we have not only supported, passed, that are the law of our land, but also written, like the Geneva Conventions. So that is the basic thing that Bush is most radical about, uniquely radical about.
Now,
but he's radical across the board. He's consistently radical.
James Madison warned us of this. On April 20th, 1795, this was before he became president. This was just after he shepherded through the, well, it was about a decade after he shepherded through the Constitution. He said, "Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies, and these precede debt and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the presidency is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments, profits, is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and morals engendered by a state of war. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare." Now, you were a senior advisor in the Clinton administration, and Bill Clinton certainly, you know, if George Bush was able to use 9/11 to declare a war on terror, certainly Bill Clinton had a few provocations that could have been used just as easily or with equal facility, I would think. Is there any precedent for any president doing this in the history of the United States?
Well, Bush is unique in the level to which he has attempted to politicize war in order to polarize our people for partisan political advantage. You know, it's hard to gain historical perspective here, and we tend to think that what we're seeing is what's normal. But, you know, having a president out there accusing the other party of cut and run, this is the kind of stuff no president would touch before. Would have been beneath contempt for any president. You know, Richard Nixon did not engage in this sort of thing. He left it to his vice president, Spiro Agnew.
Right.
He subcontracted this sort of dirty work. But now we have Bush. Maybe it's because Karl Rove and Cheney have subcontracted it to him.
I think it's because they're terrified. I think it's because Karl Rove believes that if the Democrats take the House or the Senate and gain subpoena power and actually start investigating things, that he himself may end up in prison, that George Bush may end up impeached, that Dick Cheney may end up impeached, that Don Rumsfeld may end up in prison. I think these are very serious and real possibilities. These guys broke the War Crimes Act. The penalty for that, the highest penalty for that, is death. They broke the FISA Act. That requires 5 years in jail for every you know, willful breaking of it by a federal official. And Bush is bragging about the fact that he broke that law. It seems to me that they're like a rat in a corner.
Well, this midterm election is absolutely central to the maintenance of Bush's radical presidency, which has been sustained by one-party rule, in which the Republican Party has been a rubber stamp. If the Democrats capture one or both houses of the Congress, check and balance will be provided for the first time in Bush's presidency, and you will see congressional oversight, which has been suppressed, applied for the first time now. That will lead to all the committees coming alive in the House and or the Senate, and they will start holding hearings, they will start subpoenaing witnesses, they will start investigating in issue after issue, in area after area. And we will learn what the secrets were. We will learn what they're actually doing now. And people will be held to account for the very first time.
We're talking with Sidney Blumenthal. He has a new book, How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime. We should point out that during the last 5 years of the Clinton administration, 1,050 subpoenas were issued to the White House. During the first 5 years of the Bush administration, there have been zero, not one.
I'm familiar with those.
You were the subject of some of them.
I was.
And in your book, you talk about the intelligence wars with Cheney first trying to intimidate the CIA and then ignoring the CIA. Bob Woodward is out with his revelations that Condi Rice was told, you know, this on a scale of 1 to 10, this is a 10 in July, on July 10th of 2001. Should we start a 7-10 movement? ABC seems to be doing a really good job of knocking this whole thing, which CBS brought out on Sunday night, off the front pages with their Mark Foley scandal. But isn't this really a huge story?
I think it's the biggest revelation in Woodward's book. It is that George Tenet, director of CIA, and Copher Black, director of operations, came to Condi Rice on July 10th, 2001, asked her for an operation to eliminate bin Laden, and she refused. She at first said that it's incomprehensible, didn't take place, it's ridiculous. Now we learn the meeting took place. Tenet has stepped forward, said it took place, and we learn from the CIA briefer that it took place as reported. So she has, you know, lied in public. You know, if we had a Congress that held people to account, you'd have hearings on this. Condi Rice would be called down to the Congress to explain, and so would Tenet and Copher Black, and we get to the bottom of this.
But Jenny Hastert is not going to
allow that. So the Mark Foley story is not disconnected from this in the following sense, that the Congress, under the Republicans, is engaged in a cover-up across the board.
Yeah, yeah. And now, this is amazing. Now, I talked with Sandy Berger a couple of years ago, and he said that when he handed off his office to Condi Rice in January of 2001 after the Supreme Court installed George Bush as President of the United States, that, my words, not his, that he told her that her top priority had to be bin Laden and the possibility, probability, in fact, that bin Laden was going to try and strike us in the United States because he was really PO'd that in 1998 we nearly killed him in Afghanistan. Clinton had nearly killed him. He told us also, there were about eight of us that he was sitting and talking with, he told us also that Al Gore said the same thing to Dick Cheney and that Bill Clinton said the same thing to George W. Bush. Were you involved in that? Did you have a sense of the hair on fireness of about bin Laden in the Bush administration, Sidney Blumenthal?
Well, there was extensive briefing that went on of the incoming Bush administration by the outgoing Clinton administration. And there were a few people who remained inside the Bush administration who had been there under Clinton. One of them was someone I was well acquainted with, who was a three-star general named Donald Carrick. He was a deputy national security advisor under Clinton and stayed as deputy national security advisor for a number of months under Bush. The first thing he did when they came in, he told me, and I report this in my book, is that he wrote them a memo on the importance of terrorism. As a result of that memo, he was cut out of all meetings and then removed from the National Security Council.
Amazing. Sidney Blumenthal, his book, How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime, available online and in fine bookstores all across the United States. Sidney Blumenthal, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Keep up the great work and keep spreading the word. 16 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. For being progressive, never felt so good.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
And welcome back. And I love my country. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, announcing the October surprise contest on the Tom Hartman program message blogs. The first person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members can vote on the winner and four runners-up. Each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed, and we'll announce the winner on November 13th. So here's your opportunity to get in and get up with that and start talking about, what is the October surprise going to be. apropos of nothing political and everything political, just a quick story I have to share with you. Every patient, this is from the New York Times today, every patient in the cardiac care unit at the San Filippo Neri Hospital in Rome, Italy, who survives a heart attack, goes home with a prescription for purified fish oil or omega-3 fatty acids. Dr. Massimo Santini says it is clearly recommended in international guidelines. He's the hospital's chief of cardiology. He said it would be considered tantamount to malpractice not to send people home with the fish oil. In a large number of studies, prescription fish oil has been shown to improve survival after heart attacks and to reduce fatal heart rhythms. But in the United States, writes Elizabeth Rosenthal in today's New York Times, heart attack victims are not generally given omega-3 fatty acids, even though they are routinely offered more expensive and invasive treatments like pills to lower cholesterol or implantable defibrillators. She goes on to say in today's New York Times, the fact that heart patients receive such different treatments in sophisticated hospitals around the world highlights the central role that drug companies play in the United States in disseminating medical information, experts say. The largest study of fish oil conducted more than a decade ago, Italian researchers from the GISI group, the Gruppo Italiano per day, it's all in Italian, gave 11,000 patients 1 gram of prescription fish oil a day after heart attacks. That's 1,000 milligrams. That's one big horse pill or two small ones or two or three small ones after a day. After 3 years, the study found that the number of deaths was reduced by 20% and the number of sudden deaths by 40% compared to the control group that was not given the fish oil. There are vegetable sources of omega-3 fatty acids as well, by the way. But why don't we pass it out in the United States? Why don't doctors in the United States share this with their patients? Well, because the drug companies won't tell them about it. Why not? Well, because the drug companies can't patent fish oil. But they can patent things like Lipitor, these statin drugs that reduce cholesterol. And they can make a lot of money on those, so they'll let you know all about that. 1-866-440-8464. See, it's just the system is broken, and it's broken in a way that profits a small number and screws the rest of us. That's the bottom line. And all the more the shame it is. Marianne in Arcata, California. Hey, Marianne.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Hartman. I wanted to ask about this George Tenet deal. You know, yesterday the Republicans and conservatives, they were all over the place with Foley. But in between I heard that the conservatives are now asking, why did somebody not notify or talk to the 9/11 commission when they got underway about that visit on July 10th of 2001 by George Tenet and some other person about this impending catastrophe?
Yeah, well, the fact that George Tenet didn't tell the 9/11 commission, Condi Rice didn't tell the 9/11 commission, might have something to do with why Condi Rice got promoted to Secretary of State and George Tenet got the Congressional Medal of Freedom or whatever it is. I named the wrong one yesterday. It was the military one. He got the civilian one.
But Mr. Tenet's still in the Bush administration?
No,
the
he's retired.
The 9/11 commission got no?
Yes. Oh, he was. When the 9/11 commission was going on, yes, I believe he was still in the Bush.
And so I
would have to go back and look.
So that's why he didn't bring it up to them?
We would just be speculating, Marianne, but it may well be. It may well be. You raise a really important question. Thank you for the call. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard, about a minute before we got to take a break here.
Hello, Mr. Hartman. I also wanted to discuss the 7/10 event. In that it's amazing to me that they just keep denying that these things ever happened.
Now Condi Rice is no longer denying it. Now she's saying it was nothing new, which means that she knew for a long time.
They did, yes, but they also took it seriously. John Ashcroft on July 26th said he would no longer be flying on civil aviation
because of
a general threat assessment. Yeah. And they asked him at the time, they said, somebody threatened you, Mr. Ashcroft? He goes, oh, no, the FBI just says a general threat assessment against the airlines in all.
We're going to have John Ashcroft on this program in a week or so.
Really?
Assuming he doesn't discover what kind of program it is.
He's
scheduled.
Well, he takes questions.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if he'll take them from callers, but he's certainly going to take them from me, and that's going to be at the top of the list.
Oh, so, please.
David, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, he was just moved to the 20th today.
He was just moved to the 20th, so he'll be on the 20th. So,
thank you.
Yeah, stick around. Stay tuned, as they say. 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up next, Peter Schramm. He's the executive director of the John M. Ashbrook Center, a conservative. going to be telling us that Republicans are always better for the middle class. This should be interesting. Stick around. 27 minutes after the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you wasn't listening, I'd bomb him anyway. While you're searching under every stone and alone, nearly in a prison chained like a dog. Never saw no weapon, that's what the experts say. Tom's a bad one, that's a fact. Ten more like him, but old crocodile. Rummy's dead, so is dead. One more license to the trip. Never saw no weapon, that's what the experts say.
Welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 4.3 million. That's the number of Americans who have fallen into poverty since George W. Bush took office. The annualized return on the stock market during the, the Democratic Truman administration, 18.28%. Dropped to 14% during the Republican Eisenhower administration. Went up to 16% during the Democratic Kennedy administration. Dropped it down to minus 1.3% during the Republican Nixon administration. Went up to 11% during the Carter administration, 15% for Reagan, 14% Bush, 19% for Clinton. Overall, from 1948 to 2006, under Democratic administrations, the average return on investment in the stock market, 15.26%. Under Republican administrations, 9.53%. 5 years into an economic recovery, average job growth is one-fifth that of previous business cycles, and wages are flat when inflation is factored into the equation. At the same time, the cost of families' five top expenditures, medical care, housing, food, household operations, and cars, have risen more than twice as fast as the cost of the bottom five items to maintain their day-to-day consumption. In 2006, families have taken on a record amount of debt equivalent to 126.4% of disposable income. We are borrowing to stay alive. Peter Schramm is with us. Peter is with, he's the executive director of the John M. Ashbrook Center for Public Affairs and a professor of political science at Ashland University. The website, ashbrook.org. And Peter, you're of the opinion that Republicans are better for the middle class than Democrats?
Well, yeah, is that okay? Is that an okay opinion to hold?
Well, convince me.
Sorry, I'm just mocking you because of the stats you laid out. My gosh, if you expect me to come back with stats opposite to that, I can't do it. I think the main thing to keep in mind in any discussion of this sort is all you're looking at is to quote you, as a level playing field. That's all the government should be doing, is making sure the playing field is level and let everybody have equal opportunity.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? It means that you are given the opportunity to work and to keep the fruits of your labor. And the consequences of that are not only good for yourself, but for everybody else, since the creation of wealth in the modern economy is not a zero-sum game.
Well, let's
In other words, just because I end up getting paid $25 an hour and you only get paid $10 an hour, doesn't mean that you are therefore disadvantaged because I end up making more money than you do.
Can you think of any dynastic families that emerged during the era from 1945 to 1980?
You mean aside from the Kennedys?
Well, no, the Kennedys emerged in the 20s.
Oh, yeah, and that was based on illegal whiskey and
alliances
with
I'm right there with you.
Power.
Yeah. Gloria Swanson was an old friend of mine before she died. She told me all kinds of stories about Joe Kennedy. The point is that we had dynastic families arise from Reconstruction until the Great Depression, when we had a laissez-faire economy, and we've had dynastic families arise since 1980 as our economy has become more laissez-faire. But during the golden age of the American middle class, when 70% of American families could be supported on a single income, they had enough, they had full health care.
The golden age of the middle class? Wait a minute.
From basically the mid-40s until the mid-80s.
I see.
During that period of time, over 70% of families, 35% of the American workforce was unionized. It's now down to 7% of the private workforce. During that period of time, the average person, the average family, you had full health care, you had a pension, you had vacations, you had the ability to raise kids and put them through college. All of that is gone now. It takes two workers to do what one worker could do in 1970. And there were no, to the best of my recollection, there were no dynastic families that arose because it was a top marginal tax rate of 90%. So perhaps it is a zero-sum game.
Oh, my. Well, that would be a tough argument. I mean, you don't really want to make that argument.
Well, I'm sure. I would say with some flexibility.
All I know is that there are rich guys, and then you look at the richest 100 or 500 people in the country, starting with Bill Gates, and it's very interesting because 5 years before, half those people weren't on there, and then, 5 years later, the other half weren't on there.
Right, and that's
so
my point.
That's good. That's not dynasty. I mean, and Bill Gates,
Why is that good? Why is it good that somebody has $40 billion?
And then the next day he may not, or somebody else has 72. The
why is it good that somebody has $40
billion
at the same time
mobility.
That the middle class is getting wiped out?
No. I mean, nobody wants anybody to get wiped out. That's
well, prove to me it's not a zero-sum game, then, because what I just laid out for you, the dynasty when it's laissez-faire and they don't.
Adam Smith and Jimmy Madison and Alex Hamilton proved that it's not a zero-sum game. The fact that I create more wealth than you do doesn't make you poorer. By definition, Aristotle and Marx are the only people to disagree with that. That is to say, a guy who screwed up on Hegelian historicism and Aristotle, who didn't understand that the basis of wealth was free labor.
I would say, I would agree with you in a micro sense. If you're talking about you making $1 million and my making $10,000 a year, probably your $1 million is not affecting my $10,000. But Bill Gates' personal singular wealth is equal to that of 40%, the bottom 40% of Americans.
So
you're telling me that there is
but
no
he didn't
relationship
make it
between
on
the
back
two of those.
Of anyone. He didn't hurt anybody in making that wealth. You see what I mean? Whereas you couldn't have said that 500 years ago.
But let's talk about 50 years ago. 50 years ago, he couldn't have made that wealth either. The majority of that wealth, or a good chunk of that wealth, probably at least half of that wealth, would have ended up in government coffers and would have continued to build our highway system, would have continued to strengthen our school system, probably would have provided for a national health insurance program, and would have made America stronger. And the laissez-faire model that you're advocating...
I'm not advocating a laissez-faire model. I'm just advocating common sense and how you... I'm actually not sort of whatever you want to call it, laissez-faire or libertarian. I just lean in that direction because you have to lean in the direction of freedom. You just have to. It's a matter of principle. That doesn't, it doesn't mean you have to be ideologically stupid about anything.
So when Roosevelt said that,
you're going to make the argument that you're going to take a rich guy's money because he's making so much more than he needs, or some other, in quotation mark, phrase, and so we can build highways or whatever it is that we want to build for ourselves. You're still taking somebody else's money who rightfully earned it. Now, if you're talking about the 16th century when nobody rightfully was allowed to earn anything, that's a different problem. But we're not.
I would submit to you that Bill Gates didn't rightfully earn that money.
Really?
I would submit to you that what we have is a system that we have collectively agreed on. We've collectively agreed on the rules of the game that allows Bill Gates, by virtue of copyright law, for example, to sell an intellectual property and maintain control over it even after it's left his hands. If I make something and hand it to you, you now own it. But if Bill Gates makes software and hands it to you, he still owns it. You're just licensing it. Bill Gates has made a fortune because of the way that the system is organized.
Well, I don't see why that's any different in principle than me publishing a book and having a copyright on it and, making a deal with somebody to print it and distribute it, and I get, X% of the profit.
As the author of books, I agree. But I also think that Jefferson made a good point back when he argued that trademark and patent laws should not last for more than 3 years to promote innovation. I mean, the fact that matter is that we have a set of rules, and those
you mean innovation is not promoted here? You're kidding. If it's not promoted in the United States of America, where is it promoted? Can you name me a country?
I think that Jefferson's suggestion that what we're seeing as copyright and patent protections are being extended now beyond the lifetime of a single human being. Mm-hmm. is not encouraging innovation.
Yeah, I'm actually open to that argument, and I don't, I don't have a good opinion on it.
Disney's pushing this thing because it's a corporation; it can last forever.
Yeah, I'm open to that, and I think there's some sense in talking about it.
But the larger question here, we're talking with Peter Schramm, Ashbrook.org, the website. The larger question here is: Are we if Bill Gates is, I'm going to try to trash Bill Gates here. I have a lot of
respect
for Bill Gates, actually.
But he would probably agree with you. That's the irony of all this.
Well, certainly his father does. I know that. But if we're going to, as a society, say, okay, we're going to organize the rules of business in such a way that some among us can emerge very, very wealthy, shouldn't we also say that we also are going to say that we're going to organize ourselves as a society so that none among us end up starving to death, none among us die for lack of medical care?
Well, I don't know if that follows. Now, I mean, there are many reasons for hesitating in my commitment to anything like that, one of which is a practical one. I've been to societies and lived in societies where what you have is what we call socialized medicine, and it is a rough go. It really is. That is to say...
Where was that society that you're talking about?
Well, a couple of them, actually, as a matter of fact. England and Hungary under communism.
Okay. Well, I was in Hungary under communism, and I was in Budapest when all the East German refugees were coming there.
Really? In 89?
Yeah, the week of the big celebration.
Well, what were
it's a long story, but it was. I've been in England, and I've used their medical system, and I lived in Germany for a year, and I've used their single payer healthcare system, and I thought it worked quite well.
Well, it works all right for
everybody's covered.
Well, I mean,
if you're wealthy in America, this is a nice system, but even then you're paying twice as much as anybody else in the world for health care.
Well, that may be, but you're also paying twice as much for houses and cars and all kinds of other things, and in part that has to do with,
we're not paying twice as much as the Japanese are for housing and cars.
Okay.
No, seriously. But we're paying twice as much as their health care.
The principal purpose of government is not to make everyone secure in his body.
Why not?
No, because that's not the purpose of government.
Why not?
You misunderstand. You want to redo government into an entirely different thing.
I think that when Jefferson put the word happiness in the Declaration of Independence, that's what he was talking about.
He was talking about the natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In other words, that's minimal government. That's why he was an anti-federalist, even, for gosh sakes. He wanted to even make the government smaller than Madison and Hamilton.
You can read all about it at ashbrook.org. Peter Schramm, thanks for being with us today. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You always won every time you place your bet. You feel damn good, no one's gotten to you yet. Every time they were sure to have you caught, you were quicker than they thought. You just turned your back and walked. And you're always there, the cause would never do you.
And welcome back to Talk Radio for the Rest of Us, helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, our official and senior Tony Snow haircut correspondent on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, well, you see, I know you know, but the vast majority of America doesn't know that that's what Tony Snow is doing right now.
He's getting a haircut.
Because he's got a little bit of his hair that's just going out in a little wavy kink bit that's going to be showing on camera. And I understand, I sympathize with him. I'm going to have to get mine done in a couple of weeks, too.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's something we all have to do from time to time.
We do. We do. And he's not traveling with the president today. And so that's on his agenda. So I thought I'd share that with you.
Well, thank you.
Important.
In the midst of the Mark Foley explosion, is the 7/10 revelation of Bob Woodward that has now been corroborated by George Tenet going to be lost?
I had an interesting conversation with a senior member of the administration this morning who was indicating to me that he thought that the Foley revelations were going to gain more traction with the American people simply because this is something that impacts everybody, every family, everybody who has a computer and a child in their home, whereas to some extent people will look at the Woodward revelations, and as important as the story is, they're going to see it more as the Washington chattering classes talking among themselves about events that have taken place.
But the if the Woodward revelation was had been a Clinton had been about in the Clinton administration, I guarantee you that every American would be believing right now if Bill Clinton had been president from January of 2001 until November of 2000 or September of 2001 would be believing that Bill Clinton was given information that an attack was on its way and he chose to purposely ignore it because that's what Bush did. And if this got wide distribution, it would strip from George Bush the ability to ever again say 9/11, which is the only card he has in his hand.
Well, and I think this is what is so fascinating about this. And at the moment, what the senior administration official said to me is kind of what's happening. That and the Amish shootings are taking away from the seriousness, or not the seriousness, are taking away from the attention that that story was receiving.
Right.
And it seems that we don't know in this country how to juggle three incredibly important stories, because they all are, well, all at the same time.
Yeah, the Bushies just tend to have just incredibly lucky timing. Or ABC released the story in order to try and trump CBS. CBS releasing the 710 story on 60 Minutes Sunday night, ABC releasing the Foley story. Maybe they were trying to vindicate themselves with regard to their phony docudrama, The Road to the Path to 9/11.
It's possible, although what I do know about Brian Ross is that he's a straight guy.
Right, but he's not the guy who made the decision about when to release it. That was maybe the suits upstairs.
Right, it would be boots upstairs. I don't think that the Woodward story's gone away, though. I mean, he was on Larry King last night. I think this will continue. I don't think that story is going away. And I don't think that the Foley story in itself is helping the Republicans, while there are calls for Hastert to resign, even though the president just a few minutes ago himself praised Hastert.
The president just praised Denny Hastert after it's been pretty well confirmed that Hastert has been covering this thing up for years?
Well, I don't have the exact language that he used, but he certainly was supportive.
Is Denny Hastert going to survive this thing politically?
I really would say it's 50-50 at the moment. I mean, if he's smart, I think he should step down.
Yeah.
Because he's making himself the center of this thing. I think he probably should go. If you've got the Washington Times, owned by the Moonies, the most right-wing paper in the country, saying that you should go, and if you've got the Christian right on your case, and you've got the young Republican right on your case, then you've got a problem on your hands.
Yeah, I think he's just hoping it's going to blow over, get lost in the election.
I don't think it will. I think there are more pages who are going to come forward.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting one.
The Democrats just have to hope there aren't any Democrats involved in this.
I was just thinking that. Which side of the aisle? Because that's what happened in the 80s. We had both a Democrat and a Republican who were both having sex with 17-year-old pages. Neither one, in both cases, the pages, because they were 17, there was no crime, in quotes. And, in fact, one of those, Jerry Studs, got reelected over and over and over again. The other guy, what was his name? Ken...
Oh,
I'm forgetting.
I'll think of his name now.
Yeah, he got busted out. Oh yeah, it was Dan Crane from Illinois.
Okay.
He got bounced out, but Jerry Studs from Massachusetts they reelected him for another 15 years. So
different times.
Different times indeed. Interesting to see how this plays out. Memory in Rising Sun, Indiana has a question. Let's take Memory's call here, Victoria Jones, in this last minute before the show wraps up. Memory.
Yes, I was just calling to say that this is just, they've known about Foley for years, they're bringing it out now, and then they're going to get rid of him and the other people that's so bad in their party, and then what Bush is going to, they already know they're losing, they're going to lose the Senate this November, so all he's doing, this is a smoke screen to get all these bad people out of his party, and he's going to declare martial law. That's the reason why, with Halliburton, they've got a $385 million contract.
You think that's why you think this is a smokescreen against the detainee bill, in other words? Victoria Jones, your thoughts on that?
I wouldn't go as far as the caller.
To say that it's a smokescreen.
No, not that kind of a smokescreen, no.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com, the website. Thanks for talking
thanks
with us, Victoria.
Much.
And thanks for the call, Memory. 56 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, a place where you can acquire, no fish oil, but your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. What a fine idea. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour with David Ewing Duncan. What happens when you get your blood tested for toxic chemicals?
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Although Blue in the chat room, you can get to our chat room by going to tomhartman.com, tells me that the state of Missouri just passed a law. She gave the Senate bill number. I forget what it was. Senate bill something or other. Anyhow, just passed a law saying that corporations, in fact, are persons in Missouri. How very, very strange. Just a heads up for our listeners in Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington. In Portland on Thursday of this week, October 5th, I'll be at Annie Bloom's Books at 7:30 p.m. signing books. And on Friday, October 6th, in Seattle, I'll be at Town Hall. The Elliott Bay Book Company is sponsoring this at 7:30 p.m., but it'll be at Town Hall, not at the Elliott Bay Bookstore. $5 tickets are available in advance at Elliott Bay for, I'll be, you know, giving a speech and signing books and talking with y'all, and so drop by if you'd like. Sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes what you don't know is the most dangerous stuff, you know?
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be, is it possible that we are walking toxic waste dumps? David Duncan set out to find out. He's an award-winning journalist and host of Biotech Nation. On NPR, I believe it is. Is it not, David?
Yes, that's right. NPR Talk, yes.
Great, NPR Talk, and welcome to the program. You went out and submitted a vein in your arm to a needle to find out what was going on inside your body.
Gave my body to science, exactly. But, yes, I had a whole bunch of blood drawn out, so much I almost passed out, and we sent it to a lab up in Canada, and I was tested for 320 chemicals that are out there in the environment produced by human beings. And it turns out I have 165 of them, and this is everything from DDT, you know, the old standby, to more modern chemicals like plasticizers and flame retardants and that sort of thing.
I'm curious if you hear stories about people who discover that they have, you know, viral diseases that may or may not kill them, but, you know, are floating around, you know, from herpes to hep C or whatever, you know, and then they freak out, you know, because it's like, oh my God, my own body's against me. How did you respond to this knowledge that you have all these chemicals in your body?
Well, I think anybody who, you know, lives in the modern age, and we have so many of these chemicals around, I suspected I would have some on board. I guess I'm a sort of pragmatist myself. It would have to be pretty dramatic and awful for me to have that kind of reaction. And I don't have anything like that. In fact, most people don't. But I do have a couple bizarre indications, and one of them is I have a whole lot of flame retardants in me compared to most Americans, and we don't know why. I've asked a bunch of experts, and
have
the best thing
I can
come
up
with.
New carpet?
What's that?
Have you recently bought a new carpet or new furniture?
No, I mean they went through all the possibilities. What they think it might be is airplanes, because I fly a lot, a couple hundred thousand miles a year. And airplanes are drenched in these things. And otherwise, I don't live near a plant that makes flame retardants. My furniture is kind of old and beat up. I pretty much wear old clothes around the office here. I don't have a lot of, obvious places where this might have happened. Although one researcher suggested that I'm comparing myself to studies from a few years ago, and we actually all may be having increases in flame retardants. So,
interesting.
The jury is out on that one.
I'm curious. We're talking about David Duncan. His website, David Ewing, E-W-I-N-G, Duncan.com, by the way. If any of these chemicals that you found in your body, this 160-some-odd chemicals, if any of them are known carcinogens?
Well, yes. And the well-known carcinogens are some of the dioxins, for instance, the PCBs. You've also got neurotoxins like from lead and mercury. I was tested for all of those, kind of the old, as they call, legacy chemicals, the one that's been around for a long time. Some of the newer ones, it's really not known. And I think the big take-home on this story, which is in National Geographic, and you can find out a lot more information in there, the take-home here is that we just don't know about most of these chemicals what the impact is for human health in these tiny little amounts that are inside of us. I mean, they're there, but they're parts per billion, which is a very minute amount. They may be, they're obviously not knocking us dead. You know, there aren't people dropping in the streets over these things.
On the other hand, I mean, one out of every three Americans is going to get cancer in their lifetime.
Yep.
And it only takes one cell in your body to become cancerous to produce a tumor. I mean, it always starts with one cell. And that could be one molecule of one of these carcinogenic chemicals interacting with one cell that is vulnerable, and boom, a person has cancer. So maybe we are dropping dead in the streets.
Well, I was just about to say that. I mean, there may be a subtle impact here where we're kind of slowly being affected in a harmful way, but we don't know that either. I mean, there's a lot of information, and a lot of experts think that there may be some connection with, say, the rise in autism. I mean, that's very mysterious that you're having a rise in something like autism. I mean, pretty dramatic one in the last 20 years or so. We have some, while cancers in general are leveling off, there's some that continue to rise. And then you have the whole breast cancer mystery, like out here in California and in Marin County, near where I am in San Francisco. There was a huge study where they spent millions of dollars trying to figure out, why is there so much breast cancer in Marin County, California? And they never really did find out. But so the smoking gun isn't there, but there's certainly a number of experts that think that as we tease out the science here, we're going to find some connections. But jury's still out.
So here's the question. Most of us don't have the means or the time or access, to the kind of testing that you went through to find out if, how many of these 300 chemicals we have in our bodies. But the odds are very high that most of us are probably carrying a chemical load similar to yours, I would guess, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty average. There's a huge study. If the listeners want to go on to the Center for Disease Control site, cdc.gov, and you go to the body burden studies, as they call them, they've tested thousands of Americans, and statistically, we all on average carry a lot of these chemicals.
Yeah, over 100 of them in small quantities. Yeah. I'm curious what to do about it. I know that, for example, one of the more crackpot religions out there suggests that people should do saunas on a regular basis, to get heavy metals out of their body to deal with a whole variety of things, from depression to autism to whatnot. And there's the health food movement. There's chelating agents, and there's a whole industry of chelation, getting heavy metals out of your body, and and I'm not calling that crackpot. I just have some doubts about
areas,
I just have some doubts about Scientology and their the way that they treat addictions and everything else with these saunas. But maybe there's something to it. I mean, is there some way to flush these things out of your body?
Well, it's interesting, having written this piece, I have been inundated literally with everything. I mean, Scientologists have sent me books, everybody has, there does seem to be a whole subculture out there that tries to say that they have a solution to this. I mean, my reaction to that is that, even if you could flush this stuff out, and I would have to look into what's true. I mean, I love taking saunas anyway. I mean, hell, heck, if there's a benefit to that.
Why not?
Why not? But I think this is in the realm of pseudoscience at best, a lot of these things. And the reality is, even if you did flush your system somehow, you'd just be right back in the soup again, because it's out in the environment. And there's some simple things you can do to reduce some of these chemicals, like don't eat a lot of large fish. They're heavy in mercury.
Does that include salmon?
Salmon, it's all those things that kind of make sense anyway. The farm-raised salmon, have a lot more chemicals on board, when they're tested than
salmon is kind of a medium fish. The large fish are like tuna and swordfish.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more other chemicals in the salmon.
So go for sardines.
Yeah, go for the little guys, the scallops.
Eat low on the food chain.
Yeah, and then plastics too. You know, I have completely stopped my family from using plastic in microwave ovens because some are safe and some are not. But you know, why take the risk? Just stick whatever you're heating up on a plate or something.
Yeah.
Use
glass or ceramics and stuff.
Yeah.
Although some ceramics, if they, you know, cheap imported ceramics, they have lead in them, in the paint.
Yeah, and the other thing is, the whole issue of who should be testing these things and when they're tested and what information, you know, we really need as consumers, and that's a whole other area, which is, you know, there isn't a lot of testing done of this. There aren't strong requirements at the EPA.
And at that, we'll have to leave it at that. I'm sorry, we're slamming into a break here. But
I hear the music.
And people can learn more about it over at davideduncan.com, and it's the current issue of National Geographic. David Duncan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Take care.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to The Pillow. I'll help you escape the matrix. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. David Poole producing our program. Andrew and Lauren in New York City running the board and keeping all the electronics working and answering the phones and making everything work. Thank you so much to both of you. Announcing the October surprise contest on the Tom Hartman program message boards, by the way, on our blogs. The first person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members can vote on the winner and four runners-up. Each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed, and the winner will be announced on November 13th. Interesting, over at Huffington Post, somebody went to the trouble, and I guess it's not a lot of trouble, of just pulling up, going to AOL and pulling up the screen name MAF54, which is the one that Congressman Foley is using. And it says the last time he logged on using that screen name was this morning at 9:15 a.m. So just a few hours ago. Still out there, still lurking about. Stranger things have happened, I suppose, than somebody like Foley, being around. Anyway, welcome back to our program. 866-440-8466, our telephone number. Alexander in Rainier, Virginia. Hey, or Washington, rather. Hey, Alexander. Alexander? Nope. We'll come back to you in a few minutes. So, asleep at the switch. Yesterday, Secretary of State Condi Rice insisted she did not attend a meeting on July 10th. Remember? Yesterday I was saying, this is the story, right? The real story is the July 10th meeting. That's the big story. And Condi Rice, no, I didn't, I wasn't there, George Tenet. And my apologies for mispronouncing his name yesterday, putting two N's in it. George Tenet and his deputy, Kofor Black. I don't remember this. In fact, actually what she said was, I don't know that this meeting took place, but what I really don't know, what I'm quite certain of, is that it was not a meeting in which I was told there was an impending attack and I refused to respond. Now it turns out today's New York Times, quote, a review of White House records has determined that George J. Tenet, then the director of Central Intelligence, did brief Condoleezza Rice and other top officials on July 10th, 2001, about the looming threat from al-Qaeda. Tenet and Black requested the emergency meeting with Rice because they were, quote, so alarmed about an impending al-Qaeda attack, end quote. The revelation deals a severe blow to Rice's credibility at a time when she's trying to convince the public that, quote, what we did in the 8 months before 9/11 was at least as aggressive as what the Clinton administration did in the preceding years, end of quote. So what did they do? Well, as they point out over at the Center for American Progress,
Woodward reports that Tena and Black felt the brush off from Rice during their meeting. Richard Benveniste, a 9/11 commissioner who learned about the meeting during an interview with Tenet, stated, "Tenet never told us that he was brushed off. We certainly would have followed up on that. In any event, it's clear not much was done." Woodward reports that though Rice had given them a fair hearing, no immediate action meant great risk. So yesterday, Sean McCormick, the spokesman for the State Department, Condi's, keep in mind, at first Condi's like, "Meeting? I don't know about no stinking meeting." And now the Tenet has come out and said, "Yeah, there was a meeting." And the 9/11 Commission has come out and said, "Well, yeah, we heard that there was a meeting. We didn't know that Condi refused to do anything." So now the spokesman is saying, this was not new information. It was a good summary from the previous several weeks. This is what he says, McCormick. McClatchy reports, one official who helped to prepare the briefing described it as a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10 that connected the dots in earlier intelligence reports to present a stark warning that Al-Qaeda, which had already killed Americans in Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and East Africa, was poised to strike again. End of quote. State Department's downplaying of the briefing mirrors Rice's approach to the presidential daily briefing, this from Center for American Progress, entitled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S. Rice and President Bush described that document as historical.
It's just historical. That's all it is.
The July 10th meeting, which was could have been incredibly damaging, was not mentioned in the 9/11 report. And there's a lot of folks wondering why. Why did Ashcroft stop flying on commercial aircraft? Why did Rummy not have anything to do with this? I mean, they both received the same briefing within a week of when Condi Rice got it. Why did the entire Bush administration stand down from July 10th till September 11th? Why? We don't know. I mean, Bush is the decider.
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation. But I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
Yeah, no, seriously, you know, he's the decider. It's,
I'm not making this up.
No. So why? Why was there no discussion of this? Why did the Bush administration decide to go to sleep instead of responding? Why? Could it be that...
when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
And that they just wanted there to be some peace? I don't know. We'll ponder that, and we'll take your calls, 866-440-8466. Drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
It's a heartache, nothing but a heartache, hit you when it's too late, hit you when you're down, it's a fool's game, nothing but a fool's game, standing in the cold rain, feeling like a clown.
Oh, this is fascinating. It was all the Democrats' fault. Yes, you read that right, the Democrats. Quoting from an article over on Yahoo News that's attributed to IBD that is linked off Drudge, the Drudge's page, Matt Drudge's page. Yes. Didn't take long after Foley's resignation for the Democrats to call for an investigation of the entire Republican leadership in the House. Democrats have begun losing their once significant lead in the polls, and a mere 5 weeks remain until the midterm elections. Is this scandal, the Democrats' own October surprise, meant to throw the GOP into a tailspin shortly before the votes? Or the vote, the November elections? So the Republicans have this... major conspiracy theory that they're putting out there, and I'll bet you, I'll
betcha.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yes, if you listen to Right Wing Talk Radio, that's what you'll be hearing. Sadly, it doesn't seem that the... Oh, here, let me just read this straight up. If anything, the episode reveals the Democrats' hypocrisy about their own behavior. The fact that Foley resigned virtually within minutes of being told that ABC News had copies of his salacious emails indicates he at least felt shame for his action. Can the same be said for Democrats? Sadly, it doesn't seem so. How else do you explain the following? In 1983, then-Democratic Representative Jerry Studs of Massachusetts was caught in a similar situation. In his case, Studs had sex with a male teenage page, something Foley hadn't been charged with. Did Studs express contrition or resign? Quite the contrary. He rejected Congress's censure of him and continued to represent his district until his retirement in 1996. Well, that teenage page was not a minor. In 1989, although, you know, I still don't think that any employer should be, an adult should be engaging in sexual activity with a minor. I can't defend Jerry Studs. And I'm amazed that his constituents voted him back in. Anyhow, the Republican talking points, I guarantee you, all the right-wing talk show hosts, they're going to be talking about Jerry Studs. They're talking about that Barney Frank in 1989 admitted that he'd had sex with a male prostitute, which has nothing to do with pages, but, you know, they'll talk about it. And he's still in Congress. And that Bill Clinton commuted the prison sentence of Congressman Mel Reynolds from Illinois, who had had sex with a 16-year-old campaign volunteer and pressured her to lie about it. I think they don't mention the fact that he had served, as I recall, 10 years in prison at the time of his commutation. In any case, you get the idea. This is the editorial that Drudge is linking to. You get the idea. Democrats not only seem okay with this kind of behavior, which Foley is charged, but they also protect and excuse it. Only when it's a Republican do they proclaim themselves shocked when it comes to light. Yeah. What is this? Ann Coulter writing this thing? Oh, man. Well, who knows? I just, you know, if the Democrats brought this out, their timing is idiotic because there's a much bigger scandal, and that is 7/10. That's the scandal that George Bush allowed 9/11 to happen. And I just have to think that if the Democrats had anything to do with this as an October surprise, they would have waited another week. And they would have played out the 7/10 thing as big as they possibly could. A physician from Seattle, Washington on the line about heavy metals, Dr. Peter, welcome to the program.
Tom, how are you? Thanks for taking the call.
I'm fine. I didn't know if you wanted me giving out your last name, so I just gave out your first. And so, anyhow, you wanted to talk about heavy metals.
Yeah. It seems that listening to your last caller, it seemed that he left you and everyone else with the idea that heavy metal chelation is fuzzy science, and it's not.
No, it's pretty solid stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a group of medical doctors, naturopaths, osteopaths, that have been involved in a subset of medicine called environmental medicine for the last 15 years. And the protocols to eliminate heavy metal toxicity, heavy metal accumulation from, you know, the human body, they're pretty straightforward. A lot of the information that you'll find, for instance, at health food stores or on the internet is, in fact, fuzzy science. But, you know, if somebody has a legitimate problem with heavy metal toxicity, you can get rid of it.
Yeah, and just go find a real naturopath, a real ND, or a physician, an MD or a DO, who actually understands the topic, the issue.
Yeah, you bet. And it's important that you also not try to do this on yourself, because one of the reasons that heavy metals get, once heavy metals enter into the body, they're sequestered away into bone or to fat, because when they're in the circulation, they do harm.
Right.
So when you liberate them, put them back into circulation as you're trying to, you know, excrete them from the body, you have to have other safeguards in place. So, for instance, mercury doesn't cross into the blood-brain barrier, or
right,
the kidneys are not overburdened or whatever.
Right, so you need a chelating agent that binds to them and then carries them out. And you need to make sure that it doesn't happen so fast that you get a toxic overload.
Yeah, that's correct. So, you know, if you find a physician who knows how to do this, then it's a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And that's the deal.
Thank you, Doctor. Good to hear from
you. Thanks, Tom. Good luck.
Thank you. Alexander in near Washington. Hey, Alexander.
Yeah, hello.
Hello. What's up?
Yeah, Tom, my new hero.
Well, thank you.
I listened to your program last Friday, and you have been talking about the new bill that makes torture legal.
And not just torture. It also says that George Bush can say, Alexander, that you or that I am an enemy combatant and lock us up in jail without our ever having an opportunity to challenge that in a court of law.
Yeah. I'm from Germany, and I know about fascism, and there's no doubt about if nothing happens, no, that we are just going down the road. No?
Yeah.
Yeah, the reason why I call is no, I called some friends, no, and they said that I'm paranoia, and no, they didn't read anything in the newspapers, so they don't cover it. No? But I wanted to know what would be the best thing, because I would like to have that bill, and I want to maybe print it out in the computer. Do you know where to go to what website?
There was a fair amount of coverage of it on most of the progressive blogs, the commondreams.org, buzzflash.com. I would visit them, and you might have to go back, you know, to last week's archives, but both of them have archives. And,
yeah.
And look at the stories. And in embedded somewhere in one of those articles, I guarantee you will find a link to the government site where the actual bill itself resides.
Yeah.
So I don't have a URL for you right off the top of my head, but that's what I would do. And I think probably within 5 minutes, I could track it down for you. So and
okay,
so you
I want
be
to
able
see,
to do the same.
I want to see you actually on Friday in Seattle. You are at 7:30 in the town
in the
or city hall?
Town hall. In the town hall, and you can pick up the tickets over at, what's the bookstore, David, for Seattle?
Town hall?
No, the bookstore that's sponsoring it.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, well, hand me the piece of paper,
here,
and I'll tell
you.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Elliott Bay. That's
yeah.
Right. Forgive me, Elliott Bay, folks. Elliott Bay Book Company. I've been doing so many of these, I'm getting the names all scramble. So, yeah. That's,
okay,
that's,
then I come to the town hall. I can. And do you think there's a chance that I can talk to you a few minutes?
Well, I doubt it, frankly. Usually there's a lot of folks who show up to these things. You know, I'll be able to sign books and shake hands, but longer conversations are best relegated to email, and all my contact information is over at tomhartman.com. So I refer you to that. Gary in Pittsburgh, and thanks for the call, Alexander. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Oh, my God. Hello, Tom.
Hey, Gary, what's up?
How are you doing?
I'm fine. Fine, but I'll be better, right? Okay.
Okay.
How about you?
Here's my thought. Oh, glad to be a member of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think, and I want you to think about this, and after I hang up, I just want you to, because I treasure your judgment also. I just don't think America on a whole, meaning us obviously, are approaching restoring our democracy in the right fashion, if you will.
So in what's your alternative, Gary?
In that I mean, and as we both agree upon, two things are motivating all of this, is unchecked capitalism and this disrespect for church and state, talking too much about a religion. And those two things are fueling, in my opinion, this. It seems like we're going about it backwards.
Yeah,
you know what
I'm
saying?
I do, and I would add a third one to that list, and frankly, I think it's the largest threat to democracy in America, and that is the influence of money in politics.
That's what I said, unchecked capitalism.
But see, unchecked capitalism shouldn't have anything to do with money in politics.
Right.
I mean, it's,
right.
It's,
well, that's my intent.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, and that's, and in fact, Arizona and Maine have done marvelous jobs of showing that it is possible to have voter-owned elections. The city of Portland, where I live, we have voter-owned elections.
Yeah.
We the people, if anybody can get, I believe it's 1,000 $5 donations and signatures from 1,000 people, then the city gives them $100,000 to campaign with, and if anybody spends more than $100,000, the city will match it. And so we, you know, it's $100,000 is a lot of money if you're running for office in a city of 1 million people, more or less, and it works. It works very, very well, and we've got some really, really good civil servants who are on the city council, the city commission, and we need to do this at a federal level. 45. Thanks for the call, Gary. 45 minutes past the hour.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed. And housing costs in nearly every part of the country grew sharply from 2000 to 2005, according to the Census Bureau. This is the New York Times today. The numbers vividly illustrate the impact, often distributed unevenly, of the crushing combination of escalating real estate prices and largely stagnant incomes. Welcome back 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Many of the biggest jumps in the percentage of people paying a burdensome amount of their income for housing occurred in the Midwest and in suburbs nationwide. The housing squeeze has reached deep into the middle class. In New York City, more than half of all renters now spend at least 30% of their gross income on housing, a figure commonly seen as the limit of affordability. Housing prices have gone up much more than incomes have. Notes one of the experts that they question about this. In Clifton, New Jersey, for example, the percentage of mortgage holders spending at least 50% of their income on housing rose to 27% in 2005 from only 12% in 2000, a 134% rise since Bush became president. In New Britain, Connecticut, the group paying at least 30% of their income for their mortgage more than doubled, rising to 57% of people with mortgages, up from 27%. The middle class is being screwed. In the meantime, Bob Woodward comes out, and this on Larry King Live last night, goes, he says it's even this is even a bigger deal. He says this is a big war. Henry Kissinger said this is more important than Vietnam. Woodward said of the war, it's going south. This is from editor and publisher by the EMP staff. He also revealed that Donald Rumsfeld told him he had seen a copy of the speech Bush was to deliver on the aircraft carrier in May of 2003 with the mission accomplished banner behind him, and that the speech originally contained mission accomplished in the text. Rumsfeld said he got that deleted, but the banner stayed. This shoots down, Woodward suggested, the claim that the Navy independently put up the banner. And Woodward revealed that the publication date of the book was originally late October, but he pushed Simon & Schuster to get it out so it wasn't quite so close to the voting. He said it's a miracle what Simon & Schuster did to get it out as soon as possible. This way the Republicans would have time to spin it and rebut it, and it wouldn't influence the elections. Right. 1-866-440-8466. Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Armin?
I'm hanging in there with you, brother.
Good. What's up?
A couple things first. I think that if we could get Air America to put a meter on the website so people could go to it, and it would start from 2000 when Bush took office, and call it the Bush Public Debt Meter and show all the numbers so that people can understand, you know, connect more with how much debt this guy's accumulated. Yeah. And then beside it, we could have a meter that says the Bush administration profit meter to show that for every dollar that he's borrowed, somebody's going to end up with it, and it's mostly the wealthy. And then beside that, we could show up a meter that your share of the debt occurred since Bush has been in 2000, and roughly half the people in this country work. So when you take that $26,000-$27,000 debt per person, it's really about $50,000 to $60,000 per working person, because they're the ones that are part of the wealth creation and transfer of this country economically.
Yeah. Well, it's even more than that. It would be about three times that, because it's about a third of the country is working. You've got kids in the population as well.
Right, but you should say that this is your share of the debt since 2000. You know, so people can understand exactly what's really going on. And then, you know, your guest that you had on, that gentleman that you debated about economics,
yeah,
and he's talking about, you know, he seems to favor unbridled monopoly capitalism, and obviously you don't, because it's totalitarian, just worse than communism, because you can't vote them out. It's all private. There's no hope for change. The point being is that The difference is that's changed fundamentally in this country. And the Republicans and the big media have masterfully changed the image of this and the perception to seal it and really muddied up the water so people can't see the difference in the transparency. Is a lot of the economics of this country now is based on transfer of wealth.
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, Kevin Phillips in his new book talks about that. How we've become an arbitrage society. It's all about moving money around. In fact, in international trade, 40% of all international trade is intercompany. It's within from one company to another. Armin, thanks for the call. Joe in Sacramento, California. Hey, Joe, we've got just a minute here to go before we wrap up the show. What's up?
Well, that might not be enough time, but I wanted to get into the July 10th and July 6th situation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget that on 9/11, the very morning of the actual attacks, the Pentagon and the government was wargaming an actual assimilated situation, which was actually occurring at the very same time.
Yeah,
we know
which
that
was incredibly confusing to them. And at the same time, Bush Sr. was having breakfast with Osama bin Laden's brother, half-brother.
Yeah, so let's not forget that they knew in July 10th and they knew from the August 6th memo that something was coming. How is it such a coincidence then that on very day, 9/11, they were doing these war games? Who put the war games together? Who ordered the war games? And don't forget, the little group out of the Pentagon that was tied to Rumsfeld and Cheney that were stopping memos and changing the intelligence that was coming in from the field and not getting to Bush's desk. It was changed in the Pentagon. They knew it.
Yeah, and these were the guys who signed the Project for New American Century document that said that in order to invade Iraq, in order to get the American public behind invading Iraq, we'd have to have a new Pearl Harbor. Coming up tomorrow, conservative Marie Griffin trying to defend her new union trashing article, Hiring Competent Teachers. That and more right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.